I have to accept what is in Australia, and most of it's very good. But the law seems to be a law to itself. How can, in the question of accountability, can you explain how a judge has to be judged and by whom? What do we do in politics? And we have the means of doing this. We have the means of exerting authority. What can we do through certain parties to impose accountability on the judges who seem to often go off into cuckoo land, it seems to me?
Yesterday, a particular person in Sydney was acquitted on a charge of doing various things at a railway station. He was apprehended by two railway officers, and the matter went before the court yesterday. The evidence was perfectly clear that the man had done what he was said to have done. In fact, it was videoed. And so the video was before the court. The magistrate could see exactly what happened. The magistrate said, "I think you should bring civil proceedings for damages against the railway officials. You're certainly acquitted, and I think the authority should consider criminal proceedings against the railway officials." The police and the railway officials are absolutely apoplectic about this, for they could not have had a clearer case. This particular magistrate is noted for doing that kind of thing. Magistrate's name's O'Shea, who might be known to some of you. The defendant was an Aborigine, and what can you do? Well, the Parliament can dismiss a magistrate. The Parliament or the government, without going to Parliament, can actually dismiss a magistrate. So what we do is to make representations to our local member of Parliament. Where that will get you, I do not know. A judge, a High Court judge, there were allegations against a High Court judge some while ago, to dismiss a High Court judge requires a decision of the Federal Parliament. And the matter was being put to the Federal Parliament for decision, and the judge conveniently died. So,
Doctor, I'm interested in how the common law from Alfred and also the coronation oath survived the Norman conquest of 1066.
Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it? With the invasion in 1066, there was an infusion of a different principle into the law. Nevertheless, the public pressure was so strong that the coronation oath survived in the coronation of William II, William Rufus, and continued thereafter. The First, as far as I've been able to see, wasn't actually crowned. He might have been, but I haven't been able to find evidence of his coronation. It went from Edward to William II, as far as I can see.
Mitchell, could you comment on the verdict that was given by the Victorian Civil Administrative Tribunal on the case of the two pastors, how he judged that they were in error, breach of the law, and vilifying Muslims?
That question deserves a long answer. Mrs. Stokes would be better to answer that than I, for she has been closer to the matter than I have. Furthermore, it is still before the courts. I am disappointed with the decision that was made by the appeal court in Victoria. I'm disappointed in that while certainly the two pastors won their appeal to the Supreme Court. It wasn't, if I may say so, a total win, for the matter has been sent back to the tribunal to hear it again, and only half their costs were awarded. I understand from what Mrs. Stokes said yesterday that there is some talk of the Islamic Council appealing to the High Court. Now, you cannot appeal to the High Court as of right, except in very exceptional circumstances. You have to get leave to appeal. I will not be surprised if leave is refused. I suspect that the High Court won't want to deal with it.
Okay, one final question.
Given that parliamentary bills can only be given assent by the Governor-General and that he effectively has a power to veto, how much influence can we put before the Governor-General rather than the MPs or Prime Minister, where most efforts are directed?
A very important question. For one of the general principles of the appointment of the Governor-General that he's to maintain the law of God, the law of righteousness, for the benefit of the people. The Governor-General has, for several Governor-Generals, not been keen to receive such representations. You would make your application under Section 58 of the Constitution. It needs to be made promptly, before he signs it into law, before he gives his assent. Section 58 empowers him to decline to assent to, what does it do? It does three things. He may assent, decline to assent, or reserve it for the Queen's pleasure. Now, reserving it for the Queen's pleasure doesn't give the Queen any power, for he alone has the power. What it means is he can assent, refuse to assent, or say, I'm going to think about this. But in the legislative jargon of the day, it was right to say for the Queen's pleasure. Even today, I doubt if they can say he can reserve it while he thinks about it. What do you do? Yes, you can petition the Governor-General, which is the right way to approach him, or you can even write to him. You will get a response from his official secretary, and it will most likely be like this. Thank you for your letter. Section 58 of the Constitution is now not normally used. Thank you. Thank you for your interest. And that's the sort of reply you're likely to get. Our present Governor-General brought a constitutional crisis not long ago by announcing that he was going to refuse to assent to something if the Parliament passed it, which was really rather wonderful. In fact, the Parliament did not pass it, so the constitutional crisis was averted.
But perhaps a good lesson for us with some of the issues we're facing now that the Parliament has been passing. Well, thank you, David. We've all been both entertained and educated, and I think when we see the heritage that we have in our law and where it comes from and the basis of England, it's important to see where that basis is. And I know I've sat in Dr. Mitchell's home and heard him explain this before, and yet it's really important, even if we've heard it before, to really take those on board as to the basis and the heritage of our law. And